Well, then I'll go ahead and get us started. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'll kind of chair this meeting. This is somewhat informal, but it may be helpful if I kind of review the context and what our purpose is here today.
Okay.
Who just joined us on the call?
Steve Freeman. I accidentally cut myself off.
Oh, okay.
Hi,
Steve. So this is the first of a couple of public meetings that the Secretary of State wanted to have concerning revisions to rules 37 and 45. And did we just have somebody joining us on the call?
Yeah, this is Kate McGregor.
Good afternoon. This is Bill Hobbs, and I was just starting kicking off the meeting trying to sort of put everything in context. I think we have everybody from Freeman Craft McGregor Group on the call. Is that right, Paul?
That's correct.
Okay. So we are broadcasting over the internet. So although we only have a few people in the room, I'm going to assume that in accordance with the public notice that we provided, that we may have plenty of people who are listening in on this presentation. The Secretary of State has been working on revisions to Rules 37 and 45. The primary driving force was the new legislation enacted by the General Assembly this year, House Bill 1335, which makes a number of important changes to the way the Secretary of State's office approaches the certification process. And so it's obvious that we needed to update the rules that deal with certification and voting system standards. So we embarked on a process of starting to make those revisions. And part of what we've done is engage the firm of Freeman Craft McGregor Group to provide some technical assistance to the Secretary of State's office, and that's resulted the joint work between that firm and our office has resulted in the draft initial drafts that we have posted on our website. I probably should, now that I think we're complete, just sort of give a little bit of a background about, well, an introduction about the people who are at the table with me. I do have Stephanie Sigelski, who is the program manager for the Secretary of State's voting system certification program. Also Wayne Munster, who is the acting director for the acting elections director for the elections division of the Secretary of State. And I also have Maury Kneiser, who represents the Secretary of State. And a couple of people from a voting equipment certification program. And in just a minute or two, I'm going to provide an opportunity for hearing a lot of noise from somebody. I don't know whether people on the line, it might be good to mute your phones if that's coming from somebody on the phone.
I'll do that.
So, again, we did publish some draft rules, and we're following a process by which we wanted to present the draft rules today and kind of provide an opportunity for Stephanie and our folks from Freeman Craft McGregor Group to kind of walk us through this initial draft of changes to Rules 37 and 45. As we're still getting an awful lot of noise on the line, so I don't know, but I'll keep plugging along here for a while at least. We did intend, as the notice said, that this is really just a presentation, and if folks have some questions about the presentation, we have a limited ability, maybe just to take a few minutes at the end and if there's any questions to clarify the presentation. But primarily, we want to get public feedback and questions at our next meeting, October 20th. And in order to make that meaningful, what we'd like to do, we prefer to have public comments and questions in the office by October 14th, 12 days from today. And I think if we could get written questions and written comments by then, our goal then is to be able to digest those, and then when we come back together on October 20th, be able to focus more on, be better prepared to answer questions and provide comments. I'm hopeful that we're going to get a lot of really good suggestions and comments and questions. So we really want to make that meaningful and be as prepared as possible on the 20th. But on the 20th, though, whatever questions from the public or comments from the public, we certainly will entertain those. We're just trying to make it as productive as possible. And obviously, we are trying to make this as open as we can before we go to the formal rulemaking process. That's one of the problems, of course, with the formal rulemaking process is once we do the notice of rulemaking, then it doesn't allow for much in the way of dialogue. It's more of public comment and public suggestions, but it's not much of a dialogue. So the major purpose here is really to initiate some dialogue with folks that we think could help us out and get the best rules possible. At least one other comment I can think of I wanted to make is we already have, I think, two systems that have applied for certification, and our new statute provides a 120-day limit for the certification. But we're not going to make that this first time out of the gate because we think it's important to have to get the rules right first. The rules are going to set out the roadmap for how we will approach certification in the future. So this first time out, we're going to try to get the rules right first, and then we'll work on the certification process as fast as we can. So with that, I guess I'd like to give an opportunity for the folks on the line from Freeman, Kraft, McGregor to introduce themselves. I do want to mention that in looking for some assistance, some technical assistance, we look to the Freeman, Kraft, McGregor group because they are a national consulting firm, and they have a history of providing independent expertise and supplemental staffing to election officials throughout the country as those officials make their decisions and set policies on the use of voting systems and the conduct of their elections. I might say just generally some of the experience that firm has. They've had two of their members that have helped the Federal Election Assistance Commission create the 2002 voting system standards. One of the members of the firm was a charter member of the EAC Technical Guidelines Development Committee and served through the development of the 2005 VVSG standards. And a member also assisted the National Institute of Standards and Technology, the National Voluntary Laboratory Accreditation Program, with its reviews of voting system testing laboratories, the VSTLs. All of the members have experience performing certification testing in states such as California, Maryland, Oregon, and Colorado. We've used the firm in the past as well for technical consulting. And they've all got extensive experience in assisting local election officials with the conduct of elections as well. So, and I might emphasize that one of the benefits to us of having a national firm like Freeman, Kraft, McGregor Group with their background is that with the new legislation, one of the major changes for the Secretary of State's office is that rather than doing all of the testing end-to-end, the law now provides that we can incorporate testing that has taken place in other jurisdictions. And so it's important to us to have some expertise on board from people that are familiar with the testing processes and the certification processes in other states. And certainly I think we have that with the Freeman, Kraft, McGregor group. So with that long-winded kind of beginning, I guess Paul, if you guys would introduce yourselves. I know since you're on the phone, and I might add that we really were trying to be pretty fiscally prudent here since the members of the firm live in different parts of the United States. Rather than flying everybody in, we thought it'd be more efficient to try to handle this by phone. But it'll be a little more difficult since we want to make sure that everybody can recognize voices. So each of us might need to introduce ourselves, at least at the beginning, as we make comments or whatever. But it'll probably help, Paul, if you guys maybe one by one introduce yourselves, and if you want to give us a little bit of background about your experience to add to what I've said, that would be great.
Okay, I'll start. I'm Paul Kraft. I am one of the three general partners of Freeman Kraft McGregor Group. Personally, I have over 17, probably closer to 18 years experience in voting system certification testing, system validation in counties with voting system issues, including acceptance testing, the development of county operational security procedures, and the resident-tested elections. I managed the Florida Department of State Certification Program from March 94 and founded the Florida Bureau of Voting System Certifications in September 2001. In December 2005, I joined Steve Freeman to create the independent consulting practice, which is Freeman Kraft McGregor as it is today.
Okay, I'm Steve Freeman. I have about 36 years experience with information systems operations, ADP security, computer software engineering, quality assurance, certification testing, 17 of that with critical U.S. Air Force systems. For 7 years after Air Force retirement, I worked as a voting system software engineer, actually working in building and supporting computing voting systems. As an independent consultant for the last 12 years, I assisted with the drafting of the 2002 Federal Election Standards, conducted accreditation for independent test laboratories for the National Association of Secretary of Election Directors, performed assessments of accreditation for voting systems test laboratories for the NVLAP, NAVLAP, and for the Election Assistance Commission, and conducted state voting system certification tests for California, Oregon, and Nevada. I served as a member of the NASA Independent Test Authority Committee and the EC Technical Reviewers. Okay, Kate?
Okay, that leaves me. I'm Kate McGregor. And I've got 6 going on 7 years in voting certification testing and system validation. And I started out working with the state of Florida and revised their voting system security procedures in order to comply with the HATA Act. And then also went through and revised their voting system standards in both 2002 and 2005. I've got a little more broad-based, I guess, oddball background because I also do on-the-ground technical assistance in after, say, hurricanes and helping various counties in Florida pull together in time to get primaries up and going if they're out of power and things like that. I've done that in after Hurricane Charlie right before the 2004 presidential election, and then have also done extensive work in Miami-Dade County because they seem to get hit often right before elections. And then other than that, I've worked with the NASED and helped them review their voting system standards before it went over to the EAC, or to the, helped with the review of the test material for the voting systems before the EAC took over those duties. And I've also served on the, as an advisor to the EAC when it comes to best practices in voting system administration, security, and provisional voting. So I'm not so much just the security system, the voting systems, as I am a little more broad-based.
Okay, thank you. Thanks to each of you, and I appreciate your making time today, each of you, in various places to carve out this time so that we could have this public meeting. I think next, maybe, Stephanie, if you maybe want to get us going on how you want to walk us through it, or if you, I don't know whether you have any introductory remarks you want to make, and, but I'll call on Stephanie Sigelski. Oh, go ahead.
Bill, yes. If I may,
sure.
It might be helpful for us if we kind of knew who some of the interested parties in the room were and kind of have a feel for the audience that we're speaking to.
Good point, Paul. And I, as I mentioned earlier, I'll just review kind of who's kind of at the table with me. And we have, in addition to Stephanie Sigelski and Wayne Munster, who's our acting director of elections, and Maury Kneiser, who's our counsel from the AG's office. We do have a couple of people from our voting equipment certification program. We have Al Kolwitz, who's in the room, and Faith Gross, who's also in the room. And I'm assuming that we may have plenty of people that are listening online. Again, as we indicated to people, of course, this wasn't the meeting to have much dialogue, but rather to have the overview. So, Paul, we may have lots of other listeners.
Okay. Well, I hope we can basically provide them with kind of a presentation that will relate to their issue. So,
right.
See how we did.
Stephanie, how do you want us to proceed?
I think we're good going ahead and letting Freeman, Kraft, McGregor discuss kind of their recommendations, and I can follow up with what we did then as well.
Okay. And maybe as if you have along the way, if you have comments to add as we go through it, but you're saying mostly we'll just kind of leave it up to Freeman, Kraft, McGregor to kind of walk us through. I think from beginning to end, is that kind of the picture?
Yeah. Are you prepared for that, Paul?
Yeah.
Steve? Okay.
We're ready for that.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and
Okay, and I guess, okay, and I'll pretty well take the lead on it and then let Steve and Kate come in where they feel appropriate.
And, Paul, I might add that one other thing is Stephanie is projecting on the screen in the room a copy of the draft. Actually, she has Rule 45 up.
Yeah, Paul, did you want to start with Rule 45 or 37?
We'll start with 45. I think the changes to 37 they're pretty obvious why they're being made. So I think, you know, some of the more difficult to understand material is going to be in Rule 45. So let's concentrate on that.
Okay. We'll just try to keep up on, I mean, we're on page one with what's projected on the screen in the room, Paul.
Okay. Well, as Assistant Secretary Hobbs has discussed already, the 2009 Colorado General Assembly passed House Bill 9-1335. The bill mandates several changes in Colorado's approach to certification of voting systems. We believe the most significant changes in the bill affecting Rules 37 and 34 and 45, include the following. The bill clearly adopts the 2002 Federal Election Commission standards as the base set of standards for certification in Colorado. The bill allows the Secretary to use the rulemaking process to adopt future versions of federal standards, which are promulgated after January 1, 2008. However, the bill also provides that any other standards adopted must either meet or exceed the present standards. The bill frees the Secretary from dependence on the EAC certification. Under prior law, even if the reason a system was not receiving EAC certification was over some functionality that had nothing to do with the state of Colorado, that Colorado didn't care about, the Secretary could not consider that system for adoption in Colorado until it received the full EAC certification. This is very important. When you take an EAC certified system and it fails to meet some specific state need and it has to be recompiled to meet the state's requirements, this rule allows the Secretary to require minor changes to systems to meet state requirements without the entire system having to go back through the EAC process before it can be adopted. Another thing that it allows is that the Secretary can now use the work product of other states. So if, say, California has tested a system previously to Colorado, Colorado can look at the California work product, they can look at the testing that was done there, and perhaps use that to determine that some of the Colorado requirements have been met without retesting that. Also, it allows the it allows Colorado to enter into joint testing arrangements with other states, which, while there is nothing proposed for that at the moment, that seems like something that would allow much more efficiency in the future. The bill also allows for an expedited process outside the normal certification program for evaluating and approving modifications to existing certified systems. And then it extends the time for certification from 90 to 120 days. Now, while the legislature has clearly said that the 2002 standards were to be used for the time being, the prior version of Rule 45 was written at a point in time when it was anticipated that all the systems being certified in the near future would be 2005 voting system guideline systems. Well, that has not turned out to be. The two most recent versions of systems to come out of the EAC process were in fact certified to the 2002 standards. And since the prior rule was written really to embrace the 2005, it's not going to work under your current law. Okay, so basically on September 10th, the Colorado Secretary of State hired us to assist with drafting changes to the rules. And the Secretary of State's goal to this work was that we were to review and develop suggested edits to the rule. We were to suggest changes that make the testing process more efficient, and we were to include requirements for any functions required to conduct elections in Colorado that were not addressed in the current rule. So within those requirements, we've prepared this first draft of the proposed rule. We view this as a starting point in the Secretary's rulemaking process. As Assistant Secretary Hobbs pointed out, this is something to take and begin having a dialogue about and figuring out how Colorado wants to test and certify systems. And the Secretary really allowed us to sit back and come up with our best recommendations without a whole lot of direction. And pretty much has published what we drafted. I gather that they liked what we did. So with that said, I'll start walking you through the rule and the changes. There are a lot of changes to this document that are just changes of grammar or tone, which when you do a project like this, you just have to do those. Where I feel those are obvious, I'm really not going to spend much time on them. I think they speak for themselves. So I'm going to kind of walk through with the areas that I figure are most substantive changes. And Stephanie, if you feel like I'm glossing over something, you know, pull me back and I'll be glad to speak to
it. I will. Thank you, Paul.
Okay, so on page one of the rule, we've created a definition for ballot style, which just wasn't there before and we felt needed to be inserted. We have also created a definition for an election management system. I don't think there's anything earth-shaking on either of those. We also expanded the definition of communications devices to include transmitting tabulation data between components of a voting system rather than just inside and outside of the voting system. Okay. On page two, we've enhanced the definition of removable storage media, so it really addresses you know, more modern devices and kind of the current devices that are out there. We tweaked some other definitions there. Test log, though, becomes a significant change. We've expanded test log to really be test records, and there was some language there that we really didn't understand what it meant. It called for the test log to be something that allowed the testing and processes to be independently reproducible. We think a more common sense definition of the test record is basically the records of testing. And this may be an area where if the public feels there are specific things in there, comments should indicate that those be added. I personally, based on what I understand of Colorado law, you want a test record that shows, in fact, that the tests were completed, that the requirements were verified through testing, and a fairly concise report that actually gives you the results of that testing. I think part of the problem with the test logs and the prior testing is they were so voluminous that while they provided every detail of testing, it was very difficult to tell what happened in testing unless you sat down and plowed your way through a mountain of documents. And during our process of auditing that test program for Colorado, we got to plow through that mountain of documents, and we kind of feel like this definition of test record allows for a little more concise and understandable documents. And that's kind of the goal of the changes we made. At the bottom of page 2, we've got a definition of a voting system test laboratory that's consistent with the language in the House bill. And that takes us on to page 3. Beginning page 3, we've made changes to the voting system process, which we feel meets the goal of more efficiency. GONE are specific time frames for each step in the process. There is an outline of phases to be followed. Phase 1 is the voting system provider submits an application and all the documentation required in the rule. Secretary of State reviews the application and lets the voting system provider know whether or not the application is complete. If the application is complete, the Secretary makes arrangements for a public demonstration. If the application is incomplete, the Secretary of State will identify the deficiencies in the voting system provider will have 30 days to remedy the deficiencies. That's pretty straightforward. He files an application. We review it to see if it's complete. If it's not, we tell him why, and he fixes it. Second phase will be the Secretary of State reviews the submitted documentation, conducts the review of the voting system test laboratory or evaluations provided by another state, and prepares a certification test plan for the system, presenting the test plan to the voting system provider. This is a significant difference that we'll expand on later in this document, is voting system test plans are going to be based on each system and the prior work to each system. So it's not a rote prescribed step of processes that you're going to do. It will be a custom plan designed to test what needs to be tested. Because we already understand from the House bill that we don't really need to be testing things that have been tested, providing the prior testing work meets the Secretary's approval. Okay. When the voting system provider agrees to the test plan, the Secretary of State performs functional testing. That brings me back to a definition that I skipped earlier. For purposes of this rule, the Secretary of State is defined to include the Secretary's assignees, including employees, contractors, and volunteers. So phase four, upon completion of functional testing, the Secretary of State produces a certification test report. The fifth phase is the Secretary of State reviews the certification test report and makes a decision whether or not to certify the system. Upon the decision to certify the system, the test report will be posted on the Secretary of State's website. And then within 30 days of deciding to certify a voting system, the Secretary of State will make a report on the system pursuant to Section 1-5-617, Parent 4, Colorado Revised Statutes. So, the bottom of page 4, let's see. I'm in trouble with my own notes. Basically, it makes it clear in 45.44 that along with the application, the system provider will submit all the documentation required in Rule 45. And one thing that we attempted to do and we were just unable to do within the budget the Secretary had for this project, I really wanted to see all the documentation requirements in a single section, and we just couldn't do that. There are, however, documents such as the instructions to vendors that can provide basically a checklist of the required documentation. Okay. There's nothing really substantial on page 5. That brings us to page 6. Okay, page 6 is a major change in 45.513 in response to the statute.
Hey, Paul, I'm going to interrupt you for just one moment. We're getting a bunch of noise feedback from someone on the line, so I just want to let you guys know that.
Sounds like it could be shuffling papers or something.
Yeah. Are you moving a lot of paper, Paul?
I'm not. Kate, Steve, if y'all will kind of mute until you come in at some point.
Thank you.
And I'll try to watch the way I handle my phone and make sure it doesn't make noise here. Okay, top of page 6, once again, 45.513. This is a major change in response to the statute. And it basically provides for the Secretary of State relying on the testing of a voting system performed by VSTL or another state and sets out the conditions required in the statute. The one place that this varies from the statutory language a little bit, and let's see. Basically, in 45.5.1.3.2, we have departed from the statutory language a little bit because statutory language charges the Secretary with determining if the tests satisfy the requirements. We changed that language to determining the extent to which the tests satisfy the Colorado requirements. That, I think, is pretty common sense. If another state is doing testing for their requirements and they're not doing a test designed for Colorado requirements, then, yeah, it's obvious some of the Colorado requirements aren't going to be addressed. So the important thing in reviewing that work is determining the extent to which Colorado requirements are met so that you can then bring those requirements that have not been met into your Colorado test plans. Okay. On to page 7. Someone will probably notice in 45.5.2.1.3, we have struck the word accurate. We've struck the word accurate because we inserted an accuracy requirement two pages later in that same section. So we'll come back to that. At the bottom of page 7 in 45.5.2.1.7, we have expanded the language on exports necessary for the Secretary of State for election data transfers to the Secretary. And previously, that language was pretty light. It said the exports necessary for the Secretary of State shall conform to an agreed format. And the Secretary wasn't comfortable with that, and I understand why. We have put language in there which basically makes it clear that there has to be an agreement, but also a process for evaluating that. I mean, what we're talking about here, for those who haven't touched on this before, the Secretary of State collects data in the form of files from the counties. The voting systems have to produce those files. There are a number of ways to make those files where they can be usable to the Secretary. They have to be in some sort of form that the Secretary's system can read in an automated process. And all the voting systems have different forms of file exports. The question is, can you find one within the system that the Secretary can use?
Paul, let me interject something here.
Okay.
It's a little bit more than just finding one that the Secretary can use, and this is one of the major features that we did on this little bit of rewrite. We need to make sure that the information being exported is going to be adequate, too. So we included in this rewrite a portion of the statement that implies that during the testing, one of the things that we will be doing was using this export to actually pull the information into some sort of format that the Secretary of State use and make sure that we can do the appropriate sorting, searching, selection, and report generation off of with that information. The part where the problem comes up is if they're not carrying enough information for being able to identify individual races or contest or candidates or some other feature of that so that report can be arranged and structured the way the state needs it. Ideally, it would be nice if we had a Colorado standard format reporting database definition, but that's a function outside of our scope and would have to involve, I believe, the Colorado IT department on trying to assemble that, and that may be something we can do in the future.
Okay. That takes us to page 9, which is also something I think Steve would like to elaborate on. We inserted the language for accuracy. The voting system shall ensure that tabulated results will be accurately captured, interpreted, and reported to the level of accuracy are required in the 2002 voting system standards. And upon review after completing the draft, we would probably like to modify that further. And Steve, I'll let you take that.
Well, we basically noticed after we did it, we took this from some previous language that occurs in the federal standards. And the actual statement here says tabulated results will be actually captured, interpreted, and reported. And in actual fact, the captured, interpreted, reported refers to the vote record, capturing that vote, making the interpretation on how that vote is to be counted, and somehow recorded so that it can be referenced or used later. Tabulation involves a slightly different process, and we need to consider either changing this to reflect the tabulation, which would be the calculated, stored, and reported, or include both. And I propose we go ahead and include the full range for this accuracy, because we want to be able to capture the information from the point that the vote is initially made and confirmed to the point that we've got accurate results all the way to the final total generated by the system.
Okay. Okay, that takes us through, I think, the rest of page 9, 10, 11, 12, and through 12 are all pretty much grammatic-style changes and self-explanatory. Okay, on page 13, we have slashed a major block of text here. The reason for that basically rules 45.523.14 through 45.42318 are very similar to language that existed in the 1990 Federal Election Commission voting system standards, and they still exist in the Florida voting system standards. The subject matter of these rules is pretty well covered in the 2002 voting system standards. There is a definition or discussion of subsystems here, which does not exist in the 2002 standards, but also which isn't relevant. We believe that the standards that are embedded in these systems are covered to one extent or another within the 2002 standards. So we are recommending deleting that for clarity. Okay. Coming down next to our next standard change. Let's see, page 14 continues that deletion of the 1990 language. Our next item is on page 16, and this is another one that we had some thoughts of after we completed the draft. 45.5.23, renumbered as point 17, the voting system and all associated components shall have an estimated useful life of at least 8 years. The voting system provider shall provide documentation for the basic estimate. We did not really change that in our draft based upon, you know, kind of a legislative expression of intent that you will not lower Colorado standards. So we really didn't mess with that language very much, except upon further reflection, that language isn't terribly enforceable or measurable. So, Steve, you want to take that?
Well, it goes back to language that was in the 1990 standards, and it was based on some work that was done by Robert Nagley, the author of a lot of those standards, in terms of some military Department of Defense procurement standards. And they had to do with an analysis that occurred that was designed to make sure that the components and equipment were up to a standard in quality for durability, reliability over a period of time. During the political process of going ahead and getting those rules applied, a lot of the material that had to be there for that to happen got stripped out. And the end result was that there was an implication and a desire that these equipment be durable to that level, but we don't have enough support in the current rules for picking up that information for that level of detail analysis and reporting. It's basically a lot of engineering work based on the quality, proposed performance of equipment, and goes far beyond the scope of what can be supported under the current standards. However, going along with that, it's the issue that even if we went ahead and just left this, there's a problem that comes up in terms of an 8-year frame of what we consider and qualify as being actual life. If we're including the issue about being able to include and support modifications, adaptions for other requirements and changes and performance of the system, this rules as stated is actually too weak to really define what that is. And coming up with the actual procedures and process to evaluate that could be very difficult. There are some things we can do. We can require in terms of documentation, for example, a history on the use of the system and say we're going to only use components that demonstrated that they had that type of durability. But the history on the system until just the past few years, many of these systems didn't last that long. They tended to be replaced for other reasons, not because the equipment necessarily broke down. I'm not adverse to going ahead and putting the rule back in there in some form, but we've got a lot of work to trying to figure out how we would go about even trying to evaluate this other than beyond what's currently in the 2002 standards on the testing and what they're working with. I think this is a challenge that the National Institute of Standards and Technology has been struggling with on some of the revisions on the new drafts for the federal standards, is trying to come up with a set of test standards that will do something they call the accelerated life cycle, a testing to make sure the equipment actually does have the characteristics to be reliable and durable for that period of time. In actual fact, most of the equipment that's out there that's been in active use the past few years have been shown that they are tend to be this reliable. And there's not as much need on this one as there had been in the past when equipment was delivered from some of the vendors and didn't last out 1 or 2 years and the vendors weren't there to go ahead and replace them. This one, of course, is likely to, is open to challenge or some desire to go ahead and change or put something else in there. But at the current point, we really suspect that this rule is not serving any purpose as it stands now.
Okay. And I guess there are two issues there. One is, you know, what level of components would be considered to be simple maintenance that would need to be done to make the system last? You know, how can a system be designed to last in an environment where you're going to have changing functional requirements for it, which can't be predicted by the manufacturer? So this is perhaps a policy decision whether you want to delete this rule in its entirety or whether you want to try to expand it to make it more enforceable. Okay, coming on down page 16 to middle of the page 45.5.242, this gets back into language reflecting that review of the VSTL work product. And also provides for the voting system vendor to provide appropriate releases and fund the expenses of getting that information released to the secretary. Okay. That brings us to page 17. Page 17, I'll be honest with you, is a major policy headache. The language that was in 45.5.2.43, we really don't think it's going to work the way it was drafted. We have not come up with a substantial improvement to that language. Basically, what the rule is requiring is that prior to applying for certification, the voting system provider will have completed an independent analysis of the system coordinated by the Secretary of State. In both drafts, that language is kind of there. I guess we have a little problem if the voting system provider is going to contract for that work, then I think there is a question whether that work is independent. I think there is a legitimate question here as to requiring the voting system vendor to do, you know, a special requirement and some sort of an analysis before he comes into the administrative process that begins when he files an application. I think the bigger issue here is even with some of the changes we've made in this rule, this is calling for a very in-depth security review of the system. It is not dissimilar from the scope of work that we do for California. It's not dissimilar from the project that the state of Ohio did, looking at voting system security. I mean, this is a serious review of the source code for security issues. It is a serious penetration test, and it is seriously expensive. Based on our experience doing these tests to this level for California, it is about a $200,000 project. From the public policy standpoint, I don't think there is a real good reason for voting system vendors to have to go through that kind of expense for every state that has a concern about security. This is a really good area for states to do multi-state testing. Reach agreements with, say, Ohio, California, and Florida, Georgia, and Maryland, which are the ones that I know of that are really into security in the systems and doing something about it, and see if perhaps you can come up with a scope of work which all those states would find acceptable. And then, the vendor can pay the $200,000 or whatever greater price that might be when you roll everybody's requirements in, pay it once and have a work product that everybody would accept. Now, for Colorado, the immediate problem is, what do you do when you're the first state that tests a particular system and there's no prior work product that you can rely on? If California gets the system first and runs their usual battery of tests, there's a pretty good work product there that you can grab to and, take as being the independent analysis. I think the draft that we've done will work pretty well if you are, in fact, taking another state or some sort of prior work product coming in. If you're the first one to have to test the system, then you're going to have to deal with that. I think also with the emphasis for system security that Colorado has experienced, I don't think you can bury your head in the sand. I don't think you want to do a cursory security exam and then have California or Ohio do a more detailed, thorough exam later on. I don't think you're going to find that acceptable if I understand the conditions there. So, yes.
Well, can I add something in here?
Yes.
There's another little bit of approach that might be considered, but this is where we're not sure exactly what was the intent behind some of the original language. The VSTLs are required to perform some of these types of analysis. The problem that occurs there is that the VSTLs are not necessarily performative to the open source security test and methodology standards, for example, or some of the other standards that have been proposed and referenced from some of the postings from Colorado. That may be changing in the future. I certainly hope so. The labs have been looking at trying to improve the quality of the security testing, but some of the reports, particularly under the 2002, have come up a little bit short on this particular level, which has triggered a lot of this independent requirement for independent analysis going on. but that is one thing to be considered. For example, in particular, the subparagraph B for source code evaluated the requirements basically is one of the responsibilities of the VSTLs. The question is, in their documentation, most of that review that they have been doing in past years has been more superficial in terms of coding format conventions, not really looking at some of the security issues. More recently, the labs have really stepped up to the plate, have been doing a better job of looking at that. But the question that comes up, particularly when we are facing the issue about dealing with critics of the certification process, of how well they're getting into the actual security review in terms of approaching it as a security test lab. But that's one thing to keep in mind, that this may be something we need to be pushing more into the federal to make sure it's being carried through to a full extent, and the documentation is provided with that.
Okay. And, of course, I guess the immediate problem is we have, once again, that legislative intent that the existing standards not be lowered. So I think we will all be talking more about this section in the future. The last item there, parent E, the prior language was the vendor would use contract or would use VSTLs to perform the independent analysis. the types of analysis that you've got here are not something that is within the certification requirements for a VSTL. The VSTLs, and a couple of them I can think of, definitely should have the qualifications to do this kind of testing, but the qualifier for the person doing the testing is having the appropriate experience to do it, you know, the appropriate experience and expertise, whether they're a VSTL or not. Let's see. I think that's about that. It goes into, let's see, there's another issue that I'm missing here. Yes, we changed the language a little bit for compensating controls, and I guess this is, at least, you know, our feeling is that these voting systems are going to be what they are. The point of this security analysis is not to prescribe system design specifications so much as it is to discover and understand the security weaknesses in these systems so that you can adopt proper compensating controls or conditions of use, as Colorado calls them, and the Secretary of State can make informed decisions about allowing them to be used in the state. And I guess I will leave that at that. Steve, Kate, anything else there?
No.
Okay.
There's a lot of work to be done on this particular issue if we're to go forward seriously on it.
Yeah.
Okay, that takes us to page 19, and security requirements, and Steve's going to jump in here on top of me pretty soon, I'm sure. Basically, we have left in place a lot of specific security requirements, you know, such as the operating system administrative account shall not have access to read or write data of the database, those kinds of things on page 19. The beginning of, by the middle of page 20, the stuff beginning on page 20 is a list of published industry standards that can be applied to databases. We have struck most of that list. We've inserted the language that voting systems submitted for certification shall have databases hardened to specifications developed by the voting system provider. Documentation included in the application shall provide a detailed prescription for hardening and the procedure used to harden the system. Any government or industry guidelines adopted in whole or in part are to be identified in the documentation. It is easy to prescribe a particular set of specifications to software before it's written. After these systems have been developed, taken through the EAC process, and are in production and available for sale and available for state certification, once again, as I said earlier, they're going to be pretty much what they are. Now, this is another one of those areas where, in retrospect, we might have written this a little tighter in this first draft. And
this is where you want me to step in, right, Paul?
Yeah, go ahead.
What we're stumbling around is, and the original draft had in it specific reference to the NSA guidelines for hardening of systems. I think that was commendable in many ways, and I don't want to necessarily pull away from that. But there was a misunderstanding on referring to that. If you actually take a good look at those guidelines, they were just guidelines. And part of the language on those was that you had to take the system, someone knowledgeable with the system, take a look, go through those guidelines and see how they would be modified or amplified or implemented for that system to work, because one of the problems on a really tight security system is easy to shut down operations or desired functionality. What we were doing when we decided to go ahead and delete those sections is the requirement says that they had to be hardened to those guidelines. And the actual requirement needs to be more that the vendor has to adopt the appropriate guideline, and then they have to indicate and document how this that guideline has to be adapted and implemented for their system. And then the big point on it for our standpoint is that when we perform the testing, or if we assume we do the testing, or even someone else by Colorado does the testing, the system needs to be tested with those the most restrictive of those security guidelines rules in place. We've had prior experience where some of the vendors have been doing a super job of trying to implement this concept, but when you actually implement the rules and the guidelines that they propose, the system didn't work. It didn't function for an election because the security hardening was too tight. There was problems that occurred in actual operations. So what we basically are saying on this one is that what we want to see done is that the vendor identify those recognized standard, possibly NSA, not necessarily restricted. There's some others out there that are equivalent guidelines, not necessarily pitched, mixed together, combined into the format that they particularly want to see, but actually reference the document and show how that particular guideline is implemented and what has to be modified within that guideline or adjusted for the system to work, and that we will test against that using those guidelines to confirm the system will work for Colorado.
Now, there exists a possibility with some of the products that are out there today that when you take that approach, you're going to find that, in fact, the vendor cannot show you that he really used a specific standard, that he kind of made up his own standards. And at that point, the secretary is going to have to make a decision on substantial compliance or not.
Yeah, I should make the mention that a couple of them have actually been doing a good job of going beyond those standards. So this is not necessarily backing down to a low quality type of approach. In a couple of cases, what they did is they've actually added to the basic guidelines and provide an additional tightening and hardening even beyond what the guidelines proposed. But whatever they propose, we need to make sure we've got it in there. We're going to test to make sure the system works for Colorado.
Okay, on page 21, we've got something akin to the same issue with operating systems.
It's exactly the same issue.
Well, it's exactly the same issue, except it differs a little bit because operational system hardening involves issues with procedures that the users and use procedures to.
Correct.
So it's a little more flexible. You can't retroactively go back and apply more hardening to a database after it's been built, and you know the trusted build has been built. With an operating system, you can't. You can actually, in test, attempt to apply hardening to these systems that the vendor had not previously attempted. And actually, we are leaving some text in here for particular hardening issues. But we are striking or recommending striking the references to specific guidelines at this point. And other than that, the documentation and the approach to testing and requiring the vendor to adopt a standard is the same as for the database. Okay. And that note on page 23, we're requiring the voting system provider to submit documentation containing a list of minimum services and executables required to run the voting system application, which is part of the hardening process, is minimizing the services and executables necessary for the voting system to operate. And that circles back. That circles back to the issue of testing to make sure that within those guidelines, the system once again operates and is still accurate. Okay.
Well, Paul, that also, and I'm trying to think of where we've got it in here someplace, and I can't think of a particular reference, also goes back to providing identification for potential audit of an installed system to make sure that the right components are there.
Mm-hmm.
The trusted bill should be able to carry most of this, but there's a lot of cases, particularly under new operating systems, where those additional services and executions can get turned on, turned off, and this provides a documentation trail to support that type of audit.
Okay. Going to page 24, and from page 24 through page 33, that we have recommended deleting a large amount of text, and that's because pretty much all of that text is in the 2002 voting system standards, which your legislature has pretty well adopted by statute. So that really has no need to be in the rule. And that brings us to page 33. I think the bottom of page 33 was really writing style cleanup. Okay. So page 34, we have kind of expanded on language previously provided that after the initiation of election day logic and accuracy testing, no source code or compilers or assemblers shall be resident or accessible in the system. And Steve has expanded that quite a bit. This comes back to an issue that came to light basically as a result of the Harry Hursty security work in Leon County. Lots of debate that came out of that. And since Steve was in the middle of that, we'll let him take this and explain the rest of it.
I should have pulled up some of the documents for reference. I didn't think about doing that. I should have. The basic issue that in the 2002, and it also shows up identical except for paragraph reference in 2005 standards, there is a requirement to restrict within the system the capability to basically modify the system during execution, particularly from any type of outside input, data input, or something else. For this reason, the restriction against compilers and assemblers not being in there was added during the execution, with the concept that if you had access to source code or something that looks like source code and you can generate it on the fly, there was a danger of possibly replacing existing code. The problem comes up in the part of the language that talks about interpreters. And the particular guidelines that occurred in the 2002-2005 said that the interpreters were going to be prohibited except for as excluded within a particular security rule. And the security rule someplace along the line got truncated. There wasn't quite all the details that should have been there. The particular problem that we're looking at is the case where the system depends on some sort of data input into the system, and that data input is processed to control various functions in terms of providing the final results, whether it be for the vote count, the interpretation of the vote, or the reporting of the results that are encountered. And in particular, there's concern with some of them in the sense of the possibility to be able to actually go in and change memory contents, memory location. The old BASIC program used to have something called a peek and poke command that you can go in, and while you were using the system, you can change the actual contents of memory in different locations. There was no protection. And this is the point that we're trying to avoid. Where the problem comes in under the particular wording on the original 2002 is that this particular creature occurs in many different forms, and it's actually hard to identify and
undesirable to restrict any use of anything that looks like an interpreter. We get into the situation where it becomes difficult to even identify whether this is a normal operation desirable function versus something that should be excluded, because we get into what we call scripts, command, control language, there's database insertions, SQL insertions, a whole raft of different variations. The concept is the same. You've got some sort of data that's in the environment. The system reads the data, and it changes what it's doing based on that data. The particular rules we had in here were developed in terms after the Hurst attack was examined, and the basic concept it says is that you may need to necessarily have this mechanism. Where it becomes most important is the type of case where you're customizing for local regions, something that occurs most frequently occurring with reporting. It is desirable that you not necessarily have to reinvent and recompile for every state, every jurisdiction, what you're going to do for that. But the particular proposal in trying to control this, if the system does have this type of feature where they're using a data file or data source or something, that data file and data source is supposed to be predefined. It is supposed to be under configuration control under part of the trusted build process and adequate security to make sure that that is not being changed or substituted or replaced, which essentially was what the Hurst attack was doing. It used a data file that was stored for the system that controlled the reports, and because he was able to get into that data file and make a modification to it just prior to execution, he was able to affect the contents of some memories and some of the reporting results and some of the security features. The three rules we had in there basically are trying to deal with that. It says if you're going to be using that, your data files that you're going to use need to be predefined. They need to be go through the security. They need to be treated as if they were source code for the purposes of analysis and review. If there's other data input that you need to allow during the execution that's going through something like an interpreter, there has to be particular attention to the use of that software to make sure that any of that data that's being loaded, there's protection built into that particular portion of the code to prevent it from modifying vote counts inappropriately, modifying other places of memory, or replace other instructions or codes. This basically is the core part of the requirement in terms of the integrity of the software and some of the restrictions against dynamic programming that occurs in 2002, but it's addressing specifically the issue where we get into the situation where we have something that looks like interpreted code going on. This particular area is a very major vulnerability on some of the systems. It's actually fairly easy to deal with. Does not require draconian measures to just prohibit any use of it. And in fact, as I said earlier, it's probably undesirable because there's a lot of type of functions that goes on you really need to be able to support, including just recognizing the conditions of data where you may need to go into a correction mode or error detection or response mode during the system. I'm not sure that I explained it very well. It gets kind of difficult, technical, when you get into the coding and the type of things going on. But these results seem to be fairly consistent and reliable for dealing with this particular problem.
Okay, well, let me try summing it up, Steve, and correct me if I stray.
I probably did a better job explaining it to you earlier than this, but go ahead.
Yeah, we are leaving in place the restriction against source code compilers and assemblers on the system. We are going beyond that, though. The missing piece there is interpreters on the system. And unfortunately, you can define a lot of different things in the system as being interpreters. So what we're adding here is three paragraphs that provide that when you have one of these script languages feeding into a process, that script language is going to have to be treated as though it were source code. And it is going to have to be protected by security in the system to prevent it being manipulated or prevent it being replaced by some other code. Is that a fair restatement?
That's a fair statement. And the third one has to deal with that case where there is some form of data input in comes in that if that actually exists, it's not protected by a predefined file. Then part of the security audit against the software needs to verify that none of that data entry can be used to modify memory or cause other undesirable effects. It's a paragraph 3, I think, in there. There's C. I don't remember how we numbered it. H.
Yeah.
Yeah. Introduction of interrupted data during the execution shall not be permitted unless defined. It's a predefined set of commands or actions. Actions provide security edits on input to prevent the introduction of other commands or the modification or replacement of existing code.
Yep. All right. So that will take us, let's see, page 35 is pretty light. Page 36, we've deleted reference to cryptography requirements of subsection C8 of this requirement because we're recommending those sections be deleted. It takes us to page 38, rule 45.5.2.7.6 seems to only apply to electronic poll books, so that has been struck. Okay, and that takes us now into our next area of policy decisions that need to be covered, starting on page 39. Accessibility requirements. First of all, the accessibility requirements that Colorado have already vest in statute, and I believe it's in Rule 35. You've got very definite statutory requirements. Those are amplified and expanded on in Rule 35. And here again, in Rule 45, you have expanded on the requirements in the statute in 37. I think these were drafted in part based on the 2005 standards, perhaps somewhat based on research that was being done at NIST at the time, and I am certain in response to feedback that the Secretary got from those who were concerned about this issue. So we did not want to take the standpoint of cutting back on your requirements. We have left those as they stand, except for 45.5281A. The prior language is buttons and control shall be distinguishable by both shape and color. Well, unfortunately, Section 1-5-704, Parent 1, Parent C, Colorado Revised Statutes, and Rule 35.1.4 require that the controls be tactically discernible. The standard 12-key telephone touchpad is considered by people who work in disability accommodation engineering to be tactically discernible. So Parent A, as it was drafted, would basically prevent 12-key telephone button array from being acceptable. So we're recommending that that be struck because we kind of feel like it restricts design of systems and is really not in keeping with the spirit of the statute. Let's see. And if we come down there to what was Parent C, Parent B, the prior language was no voting system or any of its accessible components shall require voter speech for its operation. Well, again, this conflicts with the statute and the other rule, which provide that the voting system shall include a tactile or audio speech input device. Now, we agree that the voting system as a whole should not require voter speech to operate, and we understand that the use of voter speech to operate the system as an input also creates some issues of privacy that you got to work out. But the statute rule and accessibility appear to allow speech or sounds as voter input to an accessible device. So we struck the language or any of its accessible components. Okay. And the language for touchscreen technology shall be tested for use as fingers as well as non-human touches, both wet or dry, has been struck. And let's see. The language in what was E, and I think it, let's see, I guess it was D and it's now E. Used to say voting system shall include at least the ability to activate and navigate by means of push buttons, dials, wheels, keypads, and or touch screens. We kind of felt that didn't really say anything and it didn't get to the point, so we struck that language. What's left is all voting systems shall also include any form of switches, sip and puff devices, or additional blink control devices, which kind of seem to be the spirit of that particular phrase.
Paul, I have to note that I think we need to work on the wording on that one a little bit more.
Okay.
Someplace in the editing we dropped off something. That sentence doesn't quite make sense. It should be, shall also include any form of switches, sip, puff, additional blink control devices, something supporting the use of the voting system by ADA qualified voters or something like that.
Okay. And again, I think this is probably, you know, a good place for public input from stakeholders in Colorado as to where we go with that. I think the question is, okay, to what extent do you require these alternative devices? Is it up enough, or does it need to have what are generally called jelly switches? Is one of these sufficient, or do you have to have all of them? Recently, the EAC issued an opinion that basically says that these types of issues, specifics of accessibility, are the purview of the states. So, okay, we also had a little trouble with what was F, whether the adjustability of the color setting, screen contrast, and our screen angles tilt may be made by either the poll worker or a voter. We left that language pretty much as it was, but it's a little I don't know if you necessarily want the voter adjusting it or if you necessarily want the poll worker voting, adjusting it, or both. I think, Steve, didn't the 2002 standards require, that this stuff be adjustable?
But it just required it to be adjustable. It didn't specify by who.
Yeah. So, once again, that the extent to which these things can be manipulated and adjusted by the voter and by the poll worker, I think, becomes kind of a policy question. And what introduces a greater risk, the voter trying to adjust it and getting it to a state where he can't use it, or the poll worker adjusting it without input from the voter? So I shall leave that as it is. There was one issue here, Steve, that, let's see. There was one issue here which I felt was a little strict for current systems, but we left it in place, once again, within the spirit of not lowering the standards.
And I'm trying to remember particularly what it was. There were so many on this. Let me pull up something here that's on a different, some of our old notes. 45291.
Kate, do you remember?
No, I'm scrolling madly right now, and I know what you're talking about and just can't lay fingers on it.
Okay. Let's come back to that then, I think. Okay. That takes us down to 43. We've tweaked the language on VPAC components. I hope making it a little clearer, it now states when VPAC components are integrated into voting systems, a new configuration of the system must comply with existing state testing and auditing requirements. Down below that in 45.5.2.9.26, the voting system provider shall provide procedures to the Secretary of State with the application for certification that describe, and then the rest of that content, how to investigate and resolve malfunctions. Okay, at the bottom of page 43, we have changed standards for the voting system provider demonstration of that. We've basically advocated cutting the demonstration down to basically a one-day event and giving the voting system provider one-day access to the demonstration room to get his equipment set up. I think the vendor having to set up a whole bunch of equipment within an hour was a little bit of a challenge, and since the demonstration is predominantly for the benefit of the public, allowing a demonstration to exceed a business day is probably just not a good idea unless there's a real compelling reason for it. So that reflects changes through 4.6.1.4. And then we come to lots of changes beginning at 45.6.2 for functional testing. And for the benefit of everybody that's not in the room, I'm going to read through those. We've introduced new language providing that based upon the review of the VSTL and other state reports and test records, the Secretary of State will prepare a test plan. The test plan shall be designed to test for any requirements specific to Colorado law which were not addressed in prior testing and for any federal or Colorado requirements which were not addressed to the satisfaction of the Secretary of State in the reports and records from prior testing. So this is an important point. This is where your efficiency comes in. This is where you take the prior work and build upon it. The test plan shall include election definitions to be used in testing and specifications for test ballots. Later on, one of these other pages, you're going to see where we deleted all the requirements for thousands of test ballots to be provided by the vendor. You only need test ballots for what you're going to test. I think the prior round of testing in 2007, there was a higher number of prescribed tests, and the ballot production requirements on the vendors was for thousands and thousands of ballots. The requirements on the testers were to mark thousands of ballots, and that effort took a lot of manpower, a lot of time, and also due to the complexity of doing it resulted in a lot of errors on the part of the testing team, which they had to resolve before they could get the testing findings. So we are hopefully advocating for a position here that will result in lower decks and more efficient testing. Kate, your thoughts on that, since you've kind of, I think in our last round of testing, you controlled those test sets.
Yeah. There has got to be an easier way, and you're going to have to forgive me. I am trying madly right now to switch over and charge my phone. So if I sort of fade out for a second, just bear with me. I will be right back with you.
Okay.
Okay. Can you all hear me?
Yes. Yeah, better than that.
Okay. I mean, the way that the test decks are set up now, it's almost an exercise in futility because they are prescribed to be hand-marked, and there is a huge number of them. And every time you hand-mark a ballot, you run the error, you know, the potential of creating a human error. Where, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, it was like 3,000 ballots or something like that. And it's just as easy and sensible to have a vendor required to produce pre-printed ballots that give you a predetermined outcome so that you can measure the accuracy and the efficiency of it, rather than sit there and have people just, you know, hand-mark ballots that you then have to spend hours correcting and running to find the errors, to find out whether you're going to get the predicted results or not before you even begin the test.
Kate, can I interject something in this? You may get to it, but I think
Pardon
we
me?
Want to make the point that we're not necessarily we're not going to be using hand-marked ballots.
No, but
this
I
point about the pre-printed is the large volume ballots that may be required for some of these tests.
Well,
there will be requirements
the
expecting that
you know,
there will be a set.
But yeah, that's what I was trying to get to, Steve, is
yeah.
that, you know, what we need to have is pre-printed ballots for the bulk of the test, and then for those areas that, because you know, there are certain things that you really do need to have hand-marked ballots for, but you don't need 3,000 of them. You know, you only need to sit down and hand mark a small number to test a certain issue. You know, whether it's, you know, how far outside of a box a scanner is going to read or whatever. You just don't need the 3,000 potentially accidentally marked wrong ballots. You can, you know, do that with a couple dozen. But for other portions of the test, you need large numbers of ballots. But those, you know, there's no reason to have a human sit there and, as I said, then have to proof those ballots and run them to make sure that the results are correct and find the ones that are wrong and correct those and rerun it and do that ad infinitum so that you've got a correct deck before you even start the test.
Yeah.
You know, that's where we're trying to get to with that, is that, yes, hand-marked ballots are necessary and they're an integral part of the test, but not the huge volume of them that is required now.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So that's the test plan, and the test plan includes the election definitions and specification for test ballots. For each system tested, a requirements matrix will be prepared to identify those requirements satisfied by the PSTL or the state reports, and how those requests. Those requirements not satisfied are to be tested or satisfied. So, moving on to page 46. This is a fundamental change at 45.6.2.1.5, which we have been discussing with Colorado for a while, and they're a lot of people take a different position on this, but our recommendation to the state has been and will continue to be the language that we've got in the new version of 45.6.2.1.5. The voting system provider is required to have a representative present during the functional testing to witness the testing and to provide the test team with technical support. After delivery, unpacking, and initial inspection of the equipment for shipping damage and missing components, the representative shall be prohibited from, okay, and I try stepping away from the other phone, and there's a chainsaw going outside. Pardon me a moment. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, before I lost my composure, I think I was at providing the test team with technical support. After delivery, unpacking, and initial inspection of the equipment for shipping damage and missing components, the representative shall be prohibited from operating or touching the equipment until testing is complete. The representative will be available to quickly and accurately respond to questions from the test team in order to minimize delays and errors in testing. There are those who believe, and this includes looking at the EAC testing program, that the vendor should be allowed no access to the people conducting the tests or be in the room while testing is being conducted. That is born out of a concern that the vendor will somehow taint the results. I cannot accept that as being a valid concern. I would rather have, number one, when we do something in testing that kills the system, I want a vendor representative to be there witnessing what we did and how the system reacted, because it makes the job of making the vendor's management understand why the system didn't pass and what the issue was. It makes it easier if one of their own employees has observed the anomaly. And from the other side of it, every system that I've tested to date has, frankly, fairly poor documentation. You try to test a system following the documentation. Eventually, you come to a decision point, go left or go right, and you don't know which to go because the documentation's ambiguous. Well, if you don't have a vendor representative there, you can call the vendor's technical support line and time passes while you wait for their response. More disastrously, you can choose one or the other, and you can see your entire test go down the tube because you took the wrong turn and you lose hours or days of testing effort. So it is very important from my perspective, if you want to test efficiently, if you want to cut through those kinds of issues, frankly, I mean, while I don't want him to touch the system, I would rather have the vendor rep sitting in a chair about 3 inches from mine watching the screen as I go through the test. So that's our recommendation on that. It's certainly subject to, you know, input from all the stakeholders in Colorado, but that remains our recommendation. Steve, get the input on that?
I have to agree completely. I will say that sometimes when we get into those situations where the documentation is inadequate or incomplete, we definitely need to be documenting that as part of the test results. And sometimes that's been as revealing as anything else in terms of identifying potential problems and issues with the system. But frequently it's not something that would require the system not to be certified. It's something that maybe we need to build into use procedures or some other document to allow the system to be used reliably within the context of the state elections. And the other thing I can add with that is I've seen some circumstances in the past couple of 3 years where they have tried to implement this no-presence type of situation, and the type of errors and problems you get can just expand
I want to say exponentially, but it may be not quite that big of a curve, but it can be unbelievable, the impact of errors creeping in at that point and affecting delay in the completion, the size and the amount of time you're spending in testing.
Yeah.
It's just basically underlying what Paul has said, comes from separate experience, and it confirms just exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah, frankly, I mean, I'd rather the guy sitting in that chair, when you can get him, be the chief architect for the system.
Yeah. I will say the other thing is, though, it's been kind of interesting the number of times we've actually found and identified problems that had not previously been identified because of that. And that will come up. But definitely there is a reporting responsibility on whoever's doing the testing in that case to recognize the input, but make sure they document it where there is something that has been picked up off that needs to be acknowledged and reported.
Okay, going on down that page to 45.6.2.1.6, used to be 3. The voting system software shall be installed on a workstation server and all applicable voting system components by the Secretary of State using the trusted build and the procedures provided by the voting system provider. After installation, hash values for the software and firmware shall be compared to any published hash values of the trusted build. Any mismatches in hash values will be investigated and resolved before proceeding with testing. I don't think there's anything new here. I think that's what y'all were doing. I think it's a correct approach. I just didn't feel the prior language actually described that. 45.6.2.17, this is new language, the equipment shall be hardened to the voting system provider's procedures and specifications.
That goes back to earlier comments about hardening.
Yeah. Basically, you want to get the system hardened to the condition that it's going to be hardened in, at least as the vendor proposes it, before testing starts, because you're interested in seeing if it's going to run after it's hardened. Now, downstream security testing of the hardened system may point out additional hardening that needs to be done. And you certainly, if you applied that, you or the vendor would want to very carefully test and make sure that probably you and the vendor both independently would want to test that hardening and make sure that it didn't interfere with the system. Okay. And then the results of all testing shall be recorded in the requirements matrix. Requirements matrix will be the primary record describing which requirements were met, specifying which were not. Let's see. Okay, going on to page 47. We've adjusted the language in the event that a deviation from the test plan is required. It shall be documented in a test team note. The note shall provide a description of the deviation, reason for the deviation, and effect of the deviation on testing and determining compliance with requirements. So basically create a record of what happened. Let's see. We've got an additional change to 45.6.2.3.2 on the bottom of page 47. There was a previous prohibition against testing systems in anything except in regular election mode. Well, there are utilities in test mode that are usable in these systems, particularly when you're setting up, when the election staff is defining elections, getting the system ready for an election, not to the point of the public test, but the point of checking up on their own work. There are test modes which they can use in these systems, and you want to evaluate those test modes and make sure they work. You can't do that kind of evaluation if you don't run them in test mode when you test them. So we've come to the language there that tests can generally be conducted in regular election mode. Test of test mode and diagnostic functions may be conducted in the appropriate test mode. Okay. To page 48, this comes back into some of the earlier changes, 45.6.2.3.6. is changed. The voting system provider is required to produce ballots and assemble marked test decks and spare ballots as specified in the test plan. That's the end of that song, and all the rest of the stuff about test decks pretty much has been deleted. On page 49, item 45.6.2.3.8, we weren't really sure why somebody specified that the voting system provider will provide 10 ballot marking pencils, pens, as defined by their system. We left it in. We tweaked the language a little bit. I get if I was doing a test plan for you here, I would be looking to see that, in fact, the prescribed marking devices or pens or pencils for the system, whatever the vendor provides, would be used in marking the balance. But anyway, we left that language as it was. For marked sensor optical scan devices, the Secretary of State will prepare one or more test ballots with marking devices of various color, weight, and consistency to determine the range of marks that can be read and the range and consistency of reading marginal marks. I don't quite know how they did it. I actually admire it. The previous test teams did do these kinds of read-head consistency test, as we call them, with, you know, a number of ballots and a number of decks, and they did a pretty good job of getting, I think, the marks on those things, you know, where they were consistent from deck to deck. Frankly, where the system will allow it, I would prefer to take a single ballot and do a range of marks, variation, marginal marks of different severity, and run it through the system 20 or 30 times and see which of those marks start reading inconsistently. But so that's kind of the background behind that change. Let's see. Ballot design shall be sufficient to verify the scope of allowable ballot designs for the given system under Colorado election law. You know, we've struck the language that seems to indicate that you will test every conceivable ballot size and layout the system can do. And, you know, if there is a requirement in Colorado for a four-column ballot, then I think the test plan can address that without that being specified in the rule. And then 45.6.2.314, the requirements matrix shall include the following requirements for definitions of balance. That's really more almost a language and style change. And additional tests and procedures may be requested at the discretion of the Secretary of State. Bottom of that page, these tests and procedures will be documented in the test plan and added to the requirements matrix. Page 51, I think, is primary grammar and style. Page 52 and 45.10.1, there's kind of a kick out to the new requirements and statute for modified systems. We're basically saying that any modification, change, or other alteration to a certified voting system shall require certification or review under Section 1-5-618, Colorado Revised Statutes, unless the voting system provider decides to prevent the modified system for certification under this Rule 45. Okay, let's see. And I think that's about it. Page 53 is primary grammar and style again. So, Stephanie, that's kind of about what we have.
Okay. Thank you to the three of you for going through that in great detail. I'm just going to kind of add a couple of my thoughts as to why we're looking at this and why we really want public feedback on this. As Paul mentioned at the beginning, these changes are needed in part to align with House Bill 1335. And so we need to make some of these changes. But we also realized after the last certification go around that there were a lot of inefficiencies that currently reside in the rule, and we wanted to kind of take away some of those inefficiencies and create a more thorough and efficient testing process. So that was part of our goal in proposing some of the changes that are in here. And again, this was I think all three of the consultants for all of their help. It was a great deal of help to us in understanding some of the technical aspects of the rule as we decided what to change and not change. And there were some of each in there. I'm going to follow up on a couple of things. We felt it important to remove the timelines that were associated with each phase of the certification. Realizing that, you know, statutorily we increased from 90 to 120 days, but we realize that some things will happen sooner, some things will take longer. That's just the nature of the certification process. So to tie our hands or the vendor's hands with those timelines for each phase just wasn't a realistic expectation on anyone's part. And a lot of what's in here is kind of some cleanup language and clarifying language. There were a number of things that we sat down and thought, this doesn't really make much sense, not from a testing aspect or a certification aspect, but just because it just didn't make sense. So we tried to clarify some of that in doing this. So those are, I mean, just a few of my comments. I understand it's a lengthy rule. There's a lot of detail in it. We really are looking for input from the public, from counties, from the accessibility community, from all the stakeholders to help us to create a rule that is beneficial and, you know, that meets our statutory requirements as well.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you, Paul and Steve and Kate. We really do appreciate you taking the time to walk us through these, the major changes in the initial draft. Just to emphasize, you know, when we come back on October 20th, we'll have much more of an exchange, and we'll really try to figure out kind of a relatively informal process, but an orderly one where we can get comments and questions and suggestions expressed. And I really do encourage people who want to participate, if they can, to get their comments and questions and suggestions in writing to us by October 14th, so that we can digest that. Suggested language in particular is so helpful when we can see that, and that really helps understand the input much better. I know it's really time consuming, as Stephanie said. This is really a there's a lot of material here. So, but all the help we can get is really appreciated. One minor thing I meant to mention at the beginning that it was a little confusing to me, and I don't know whether anybody else noticed it, but the footer on both documents had May 21st, 09, and maybe it was obvious to everybody else except me, but that was, I think that was just the version of the rules that are being amended, the last version of the rules. I first thought that meant there would have been a prior draft or something, but that's not the case.
My copy has that being struck out.
And I didn't, and you're right, I thought maybe that meant that we started drafting May 21st, and now this draft is 9/29, but like I say, it's probably just me.
Yeah, that was the amended date on the, what Stephanie sent me is the official version of the current rule.
I think that's right, good.
Okay.
I don't know that we have anything else then, so if there are, whatever anybody wants to submit in writing, I guess, Stephanie, they should be emailed to you, is that correct? Stephanie.Segelski at...
Bill?
Yes?
Bill. We need to cover Rule 37 yet.
Okay.
That is fairly brief.
Okay, good. I actually weren't sure we were going to do anything specifically, but let's definitely talk about that then. Stephanie's putting Rule 37 up on the screen.
Okay, and I'm getting it up on my screen because I didn't do a printout of it this morning. For where I put it. Okay, I've got my copy up. Okay, I guess you want me to take it, Steph?
Yeah, Paul, go ahead.
Okay, and I'm looking at my draft copy, so if you made changes subsequent to mine, I'm going to miss them. But I'm showing a change to 37.1.5, where we deleted the language by the first federal election held after January 1, 2006. And then the bottom of page 2, the adoption of the voting system standards in paragraph 37.3.1, we have deleted the language at the end of the paragraph, which previously read, and be certified by an independent testing authority certified by NASED. We have deleted 37.32, upon any revision or new release of the Election Assistance Commission, the Secretary of State hereby automatically adopts standards to be promulgated. Well, that kind of flies in the face of the clear reading of the statute, so 37.3.2 is deleted. 37.3.3, we've got language now that any voting system or equipment submitted to the Secretary of State for certification shall meet the federal voting system standards adopted in this rule at the time the voting system equipment is submitted to the Secretary of State. And we struck the language in effect at the time because we assume that any future standards will be adopted within 37. Then... once again, on 37.3.4, we've struck the language on or after December 13, 2007. That's everything that I've got.
Okay, thank you. Any more comments, Paul, from you or Steve or Kate? If not?
None that I can think of, Bill. We would like to thank the Secretary very much for entrusting us with this work, and we appreciate the honor.
Well, thank you. And I probably should point out also that Stephanie's team, is also working on the draft rules with Freeman Craft McGregor Group, and that includes Danny Casillas and Jerome Lovato, and which, as I indicated, they're here as well. So again, the written comments, questions, suggestions, whatever, email to Stephanie Segelski, Stephanie.Segelski, C-E-G-I-E-L. SKI at sos.state.co.us. Anybody have anything else? Al? Why don't you come to the, if you have, and I'm assuming you just have questions about the presentation or the procedure, but if you'll come to the microphone so everybody can hear you.
Am I on?
I think so.
Is it hot? Good. I'm Al Colas. I'm with Colorado Voter Group. And I have a question about the presentation. I sat through the public portion of the certification process for each of the four vendors, seems like a century ago. starting perhaps earlier than that, but at least since then, there have been a very substantial number of documents filed with the Secretary of State regarding the certification process. And I'm wondering if the consultants have written a report that analyzes all of that input that you have had so that we can see what we don't have to repeat.
I'm not sure. Go ahead, Paul.
We have not reviewed the prior input to the Secretary's rulemaking process. We basically took, the clear wording of the statute, the existing rule that is there, and have made suggested changes to it. I'm not sure. I mean, given that a lot of that public comment would have been coming in on the heels of a prior rule that's now two generations old, I'm not sure how much of that input would be applicable to what we're doing now in the wake of these statutory changes. It's certainly the Secretary's call whether they want us to dig into that, but no, at this point in the process, as I said, we've taken the statutory change, we've taken the existing rule, and we have attempted to make changes to the existing rule which make the testing process more effective without lowering the standards and while meeting the new statutory requirements. And thus far, that's been the scope of our review.
Paul, can I make a comment in here? It's almost more of a question in some ways.
Yes, Steve.
My understanding of the process that we're doing on this particular one is we were trying to provide as quick a response as needed under the timelines that the Secretary of State's office had to deal with the bill change. This is not necessarily what would be the term, bottom to top to bottom review of all the rule requirements, revision updates to standards to make them the best we possibly can. It is much, much a smaller scope of trying to deal with the existing rule and to adapt to be able to go forward on what needs to be done in the next couple of months under the House bill that came out.
Yes, and I
think we're probably talking about, in terms of reviewing that documentation from the prior input, on possibly a second stage to follow this. This is mainly just an intermediate stage to carry forward. Am I correct? Or am I misunderstanding something?
I don't know that, well, I think budgets and needs are going to determine to the extent to which this is interim work, but yes, the Secretary of State had to respond very quickly, being handed a clear mandate by his legislature to make changes, and then on top of that, getting applications for systems coming in out of the EAC process. So we have moved very quickly on this. I think our total time to work on this has now spanned roughly 3 weeks since the Secretary engaged us.
And part of that was we were trying very hard not to introduce new requirements. There's a number of places new requirements would probably be desirable, but that's to be a decision outside the scope of what we were doing.
Okay, thank you. Anything else, Al?
Just a question. If this is not the real rule change, then is there a schedule for a real rule change to incorporate all of the problems that we experienced?
I'm not sure I follow. I mean, this is the real rule change. We're drafting changes to the existing rules.
Well, it will be an official rule change.
Yes.
But as I understand it, this is not a comprehensive rule change. It's a patch.
Well, it's whatever you think it should be. I think we're soliciting that kind of input. And if whatever amendments you want to suggest, that's what we're soliciting.
This is intended, Al, to be a starting point for the Secretary of State and the citizens of the Colorado to start discussing this and moving forward to develop a rule. I mean, I don't think the Secretary of State has any particular agenda in developing a new rule other than finding something that will work better for Colorado than the past rule and something that meets the current statutory requirements.
Bill, I just don't want to trying to get a lot of people to work on this if the objective is basically to do a spell check on this document.
Not at all. No, I think, as we said, we're looking for whatever it takes to adapt the existing rules to the new legislation and as Stephanie said, apply the lessons learned. There's no agenda. We just want the best rules we can get.
Well, can I ask if we do submit documentation, and we'd be assured that the documentation will be responded to. And I don't mean read, and I don't mean that if we like it, we'll reflect it in the change, but you'll respond that we're not going to do this because.
I think so. I want to qualify that because I'm not sure I know exactly what documentation you're talking about providing. But what we're focusing on is amendments to the rules. So if you have whatever in the nature of questions or suggestions, the proposed language, all of that will be taken in. And the purpose of the next hearing is to try to go over that.
Let me give you an illustration to help clarify what we're talking about. One of the biggest problems that I saw during the earlier certification was issues around the idea of the role of the public in the certification process. What could the public see? What could the public not see? We were very, very careful to pre-alert vendors while we were in the room to not disclose anything that they considered to be proprietary. The Secretary's office apparently did not do that because when the test results were officially printed, they were essentially blacked out pages with nothing on them. Everything was redacted. The reason being that you had accepted a lot of proprietary information. We understand. This rule should say, for example, that no proprietary information will be allowed to be seen.
And okay, then that's helpful because that's the kind of thing we're asking for. If that's a suggestion for the rules, then we'd love to consider that, and preferably in writing. That's a good idea.
We have maybe an inch. We'll submit.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Does anybody have anything else? Then I guess we are done. Again, thanks to everybody for coming, for participating, and we will reconvene around October 20th, I think it's from 9 a.m. to 12 noon. So, okay, thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.